Danaholics. My name is Christine Owen, and today I have an even more special guest than I've had before because I have Ryan Galuzzo, Identity Program Lead at NIST. And the reason that we're talking today and we're going to have this little, I would call it a bonus episode, is because they released
Oh,
this
no.
big, massive document. And I had to kill so many trees for this, Ryan. So we've got
Upside down.
63-4. And we're going to talk a little bit about it, but we're also going to do a lot of demystifying of NIST. So, first off, thank you so much for coming, Ryan.
Thank you for having me. I don't know about even more special, but I do appreciate the opportunity to get on here and talk to your audience today.
Thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, no, I think it is even more special because I feel like people are always scared when they get NIST documents. They don't know what to do with them. So we're going to talk about what to do with them besides read them and try to figure out how to comply with them. So first off, I wanted to talk about a little bit about yourself and how you ended up where you ended up, because I feel like it's not like you woke up one day and said, "Boy, I really want to write standards for a living." Or maybe you did. I don't know.
No, not at all. I am here, I think, like most people in the identity space, largely by accident. I like to tell people that I ended up here because of a Boston Red Sox hat. So I guess rewinding back to about 2011, I had previously been in the Army where I was an artillery officer. I had decided I was very much done with that particular phase of my life, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do, like at all. I was thinking either go back to school and become a history professor or an archaeologist, or become like a super special secret agent in the intelligence community. And while those are vastly different, I didn't really have a good idea of what I wanted to do. So got out, was kind of just lounging around at my parents' house in Massachusetts doing almost nothing. My father, who had been in the intelligence community for a long time, had a random business trip down to Washington, D.C., and he decided to wear his Red Sox hat one day to go to a Starbucks in Ballston. And when he was there, a former colleague of his saw that Red Sox hat and said, "Man, that looks a lot like Mark Galuzzo. I'm going to go say hello real quick." It turned out that that woman was the director of a nonprofit called the Intelligence and Not and National Security Alliance. And she said, "Hey, you know, my dad said, hey, you know, my son is just sitting around eating my food, taking up space at my house. It would be really nice if he could come meet with you and have a conversation." And so I went and interviewed with them, and I got an internship. And when I was at that internship, I ended up helping work on a white paper about interoperability and reciprocity of background investigations. So this was my kind of first introduction to both the world of kind of like federal standards and federal guidance and federal policy and identity. I really liked it, thought it was interesting, and ended up meeting some folks from Deloitte while I was doing that internship. And those folks from Deloitte were looking to build out a team to help support NIST and the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace and STIC. And so I ended up getting a job there and found myself not long after that as the sole person showing up almost every day at the Department of Commerce to work with really the heavyweights in the space. Jeremy Grant was the director of the program office. David Temeshock was there. Naomi Lefkowitz was there. I mean, you know, a who's who, like Mike Garcia joined not long after that. And so, like, you know, I very quickly found myself in the deep end of identity. Really, it didn't change after that. So I spent a long time working at the NSTIC program office through the days of standing up the Identity Ecosystem Steering Group and working on the Identity Ecosystem Framework, and then working on some international standards with them. And that's pretty much where I entered the identity space. And because it's identity, they don't allow you to leave, and so
Yeah,
I'm here.
that's
But
true.
like truly, truly loved. I mean, I think the big thing there was not just the introduction to identity, but the introduction to NIST as an organization. And to me, it was kind of the best of both worlds. I had been looking, you know, partially for like being involved in like important policy at like a national level, important work at a national level, you know, through that, like, hey, maybe I want to become like a member of the intelligence community, but also the academic world. And so it was kind of like this really nice blend of both. And NIST in particular has this like wonderful culture of like academic focus and collaboration and coordination. And so it was like, I just loved it. Like I really, really loved, NIST as an organization. And after leaving the NSTIC project and doing some work at different agencies, Treasury, IRS, you know, the opportunity to come back to NIST came up and absolutely jumped at it. And here I am. So I've been about 2 years now, 2.5 years, I think, at NIST as the identity program lead. So it was
awesome. You know what I love about NIST?
Fortuitous.
What I love about NIST is not just like the people are really nice because the culture is really good, but also there's this beautiful weeping willow tree outside of the cafeteria and campus, and I love that tree. It's like such a pretty tree.
Well, it's currently off limits, so they've been in the process of doing a very elaborate renovation of our cafeteria. So the cafeteria is closed, as well as the courtyard and around the cafeteria. I believe the weeping willow is still there. But even with like some nice little chairs like underneath it, so you have this like beautiful shade. But yeah, all that's still closed. I don't know when it's going to be opening back up again. But we are looking forward to it because having a full cafeteria again, I think would be nice.
Yeah, I actually was wondering if you guys had. Yeah, I mean you're in the middle of nowhere, not really, but it's hard to get in, on and off that campus. I feel like tucked in the back.
I don't have the most ideal commute because I live in Fairfax and commute all the way up to Gaithersburg when I do come to campus, but it's quiet, it's beautiful, there's nature, there's wildlife, there's, you know, it's a really nice campus, and it's really enjoyable to come here. Cafeteria.
Yeah, situation. Yeah, you've got that whole herd of deer that you can't do anything about.
You had a bear at one point in time, I believe.
You had a bear?
Yeah, somebody is probably going to correct me on this, I guess, in your comments or something, but there was a bear. It was called Gaither's Bear, and I think we even very briefly had like a Gaither's Bear Twitter handle or something like that as well, too. So
that's awesome. All right, so wonderful protected land you have up there. But all right, so let's get down to brass tacks, which is 63, right? So 863 is the identity guidelines. They're essentially this gold standard for the US practitioners, not just for the government, but also for a lot of the vendors. So one thing that I hear a lot, and I try to correct this, so I would love to hear how you respond to this, but a lot of people complain that it takes so long. And so in my opinion, I think it makes sense because of the process that you guys have in place. You know, 63-3 came out in 2017, I think, right? Or 2018. And you try to be forward thinking for as far forward as you can. But the problem is then we had COVID and a lot of technology really advanced way faster than we thought it would, which is a good and bad thing because standards had to get back up. So was it, I think it was either 2021 you guys started doing, was it 2021 or 2022 you started reaching out to vendors?
So I believe in 2020, there was kind of like a call for feedback to seek input on like what we should do next. Like, where should we take the guidance from where we are? Obviously that then rolled into, to your point, a lot of the stuff that happened during the pandemic. We learned a ton from, you know, having conversations with folks about what worked, what didn't work, what happened, you know, where we saw different kinds of threats. Obviously that was I don't want to say it was a paradigm changer so much as it kind of shined a light on the importance of things like identity proofing and authentication and kind of doing things from a very kind of risk-based perspective. So I think that was immensely valuable to provide feedback to us. And as far as like the timeline goes, the other thing to think about with a lot of this is, you know, post 2020, 2021, 2022, we're starting to see an emergence of new techniques, so things like verifiable credentials, mobile driver's license, digital wallets, all those standards start to kind of peak around that point and start to move towards more finalization and more maturity. We've also got things like passkeys emerging within the FIDO ecosystem. So there's like this point that we get to in kind of mid to late, like 21, 22 kind of timeframe of a whole bunch of stuff happening at once. And so that's why when we put out the guidance in December of 22, there were a lot of things where we had like cracked the door on them. So like, you know, we had made some minor changes to account for the possibility of being able to clone and export keys to support concepts such as passkey. But we didn't go really far with that yet. We had cracked the door on things like digital evidence. So mobile driver's license, verifiable credentials. And a lot of what we got was, we need more. And at the same time, we needed an opportunity for a lot of the thinking and other standards that are maturing in the space to really start to solidify around what those were going to look like, what implementations were going to look like before we could really kind of continue to refine all the requirements that we were ultimately putting in. So there was kind of a cycle that resulted in us, you know, as they were actually updating all of the core standards to support some of these new technologies, that we wanted to make sure we were building in, because the last thing we wanted to do is put it out in 22 mm-hmm. or 23. And then all of a sudden we have a whole bunch of new technologies and we have to update it, you know, a year later, or worst case, you know, the standard is essentially outdated the day it gets published, which is a bad thing. So we wanted to make sure that we gave some of those things some time to mature. At the same time, there was so much that we had kind of changed from what was in revision 3 that we got thousands of comments. So, I mean, in December of 22, we released the first public draft of 63 revision 4. We had a 119 day public comment period. And it was very intentional because, again, we knew there's a lot of things changing. We wanted to have a lot of very deliberate conversations. We wanted to get feedback from organizations that we didn't typically get feedback from. So like state level organizations, civil society, privacy experts, you know, folks that were looking at the equity side of the house when it comes to things like benefits and benefits distributions. We really wanted to have like a robust period of communication and engagement, and it worked. We got 3,876 comments, I think was like the exact number, once we took like the big comments and broke them down into like the individual items, which is a lot. So we had to deal with each one of those items, a very deliberate process for making sure that we understood what we were going to accept, what we weren't going to accept, and kind of deduplicating a lot of those things and making sure that we covered the important topics. And, you know, that took a while. But, you know, as you mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago, not last week,
2 weeks ago,
2 weeks ago, we released a second public comment draft. We really felt that was necessary here because we made some pretty substantial changes even from the last public comment period. And when you're addressing 3,876 comments, it wouldn't be very, I think, effective to try and transition directly from that to a final. So we wanted to make sure we had another round of being able to vet these with the larger community. And I think that's a really important point about a lot of the work we do here at NIST is this is, yes, we kind of manage and shepherd this process, and we do have a lot of subject matter expertise in a lot of these things, but we want to make sure it is an open and collaborative process that takes in the best from industry, the best from academia, the best from kind of the entire ecosystem, to make sure that it is something that one is practical and implementable, and two is also going to have broad adoption and support, not just within the government, but also in commercial. So we brought all those things together and realized, you know, we definitely needed to do a second public comment period on the stuff. And that's what we got out the door about 2 weeks ago.
So how do you, when you guys, when you were deliberately reaching out, were you reaching out to certain organizations to try to get to have conversations with them? Do you target organizations, or do you passively allow them to come to you, or a little bit of both?
We do both. So I think we were very deliberate in targeting for this. So we went to, I mean, the number of events that we went to that we probably would not have normally gone to during the public comment period last year or last time around was substantial, probably more so than any of the team were necessarily prepared for. But, you know, we were going to, you know, state level events on cybersecurity. We were going to privacy events. We were going to you know, every opportunity for like federal forums that we could find to try and make sure that we got news out about this and what the major changes were. We targeted very specific organizations that we wanted to go have conversations with because of their role in the larger ecosystem. And at the same time, anyone, almost anyone who reached out and said, hey, we'd like to have a conversation about this, we accepted that conversation. Like, we really wanted, given the, you know, the level of visibility, the level of importance that was being placed on identity proofing, identity verification, authentication, and federation, and kind of the wake of, you know, COVID, as well as, you know, what we were seeing from an emerging technology perspective, we wanted to make sure we were covering the biggest spectrum possible. So, you know, and we'll be doing it as well during this public comment period. It won't be a 119-day public comment period because we do have to bring this to final, but we will be, you know, deliberately engaging and targeting folks within commerce or within the commercial space, within the academic space, as well as opening the doors to folks who want to have conversations with us. So if you're out there and you're listening and you have something you love, we're more than happy to talk to you about it. If you have something you hate, we're more than happy to talk to you about it. If you just want to ask some questions before you provide your public comments, we're more than happy to talk to you about it. So reach out, let us know, get something set up, and we're more than happy to have a conversation and understand what, you know, various different perspectives are and what we've done with the guidance.
Yeah, I'm sure Ryan's tired of talking to me about it over and over again.
No, you're one of my favorite sounding boards.
Yeah, I do enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. And I think that this is something that's really important for people to understand, that it does, if, as long as you're kind of like are in the space and, or you're affected by this, you understand, you can read the guidelines, you understand them to a point. You don't have to fully understand them. I know I didn't understand C for quite some time until this year. So you don't have to always fully understand. But as long as you do have comments or you have questions, it's really important to get those in. If you're a small micro agency and you have a weird use case, that's something that's really valuable to be able to understand what the, whether these standards really do meet as many of the use cases as they need, as they're trying to hit, right? Because you can't hit all the use cases with standards. It's impossible. You can never get to 100%, but getting to 99 is really important. What I found in having worked with a ton of different people, I found that some people are like scared of NIST. They didn't know that you could actually talk to them. I think they think of you guys like procurement officers or something. Do you guys have that same issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like two different like sets of like groups that we kind of interact with, and they react to us in different ways. Like, there's definitely the people who work with NIST and understand NIST and kind of have been in the space of standards development and the work that NIST does for a long time, know that they can have these collaborations, understand that like this is what we really want to do. But there is definitely a completely separate world of like, these are things that come from somewhere and we're told to comply with them, and we don't realize that we can reach out and have that kind of engagement. So if you find yourself in that latter camp of we've been told we have to do the NIST, and you know, we're trying to figure out how to do the NIST, you can pick up the phone and give us a call, you can shoot us an email, you can have a conversation. And frankly, if you have feedback and learnings of where the NIST is not doing the thing that you wanted, we can certainly engage on that and understand, you know, what your particular use case is and explore, you know, how that can impact our guidance overall. It's certainly intended to be a two-way street and a conversation and collaboration. And, I don't own an operational identity system, right? So we do rely on feedback from agencies and organizations that are interacting with end users on a day-to-day basis to make sure we're getting a lot of this stuff right. So if you're out there and you've been kind of, you didn't understand that you could do this, or you were afraid to potentially do this, like, reach out. We're happy to hear from you and happy to understand what it is that that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I will say, like, the NIST has become less of an ivory tower. 63.3 definitely broke it down a little bit. There was a lot of outreach during that period. I think you guys are taking that and going even further, which is perfect and really good. And I think the other thing for practitioners who are either new to the space or system owners who know they have to, they're required to do the NIST, like, especially there's a lot of system owners actually that are not in the government space. They're healthcare, so they're adjacent, and they're required by DEA regulations, right, to follow NIST guidelines. In those cases, those are a lot of people who don't live and breathe this like we have. You know, we came up living and breathing NIST and all the other federal requirements. We understand what it means. But I think that those people, especially reaching out to NIST or finding a practitioner who is really in tune with NIST, is really important because, you know, it's not as black and white as it seems on paper. There is an entire risk-based approach, which, by the way, Ryan, I'm so happy you guys changed your risk-based approach and changed your methodology. I love it. Maybe I remember a comment on this, but I think that that piece like gets very confusing, that it's like you can't always do X and Y to get Z when it comes to a person's identity. Sometimes you have to go all around the lines to figure it out. So, you know, I think that that's really important for people to remember.
I want to say thank you for the call out on the openness and 63 being part of that, like, you know, breaking down the ivory tower stuff. Paul Grassi, Mike Garcia, Jeremy Grant, like that whole team did a lot of really, really, really critical work that set a great template and foundation for what we're trying to do now on revision four as well too. So like, you know, the whole standing on the shoulder of giants thing and, you know, driving forward on that. I would say from a risk-based approach, like I think people are often surprised when they have conversations with us because we really, at least programmatically, our focus is not strict conformance and compliance. Our focus is on trying to give agencies the like tools that they need to make the best risk-based decisions possible, right? Like if you're purely focused on compliance and conformance, you know, it's not going to solve all your problems, right? Like you need to really be able to look at this from the perspective of balancing, understanding, and managing risk across the board. And what we're trying to do with all, you know, all four of the volumes, not just the risk management volume, but like all of them, is really lay out, you know, how we want you to do these things, the best way to potentially do these things, but also try and provide optionality and different pathways for organizations to be able to implement what makes sense to them, and also understand where they might have to make some risk-based decisions, and really focus most on like documenting those, right? Like, because I think, you know, the idea that you're going to have a solution where you don't have to make some of those trade-offs or risk-based decisions is a little bit impractical. And so like we understand that, and what we want to do is be able to write to give people a good understanding of what we think the best case scenarios look like, but also understanding that we want to give you the pathways and flexibilities to make the decisions that are correct for your use case, that are correct for your users and your populations, and correct for your threat environment, right? So hopefully that level of flexibility is kind of coming through in what we've put through in the risk management process, but it's really about risk management tools more so than driving hard compliance conversations.
Yeah, I think actually a light bulb just went off. I think a way for cybersecurity practitioners to really think about it is in every system in cybersecurity, there's always some sort of exception. Someone always gets an exception. It doesn't matter. You can be as strict as you want, and there's always this one random person out in the middle of nowhere, and they get an exception for, you know, whatever it is that they're doing for their system, for how they get in, whatever it is, because they need it in a completely different, you know, unicorn-y way. And so I like to think of the guidelines like that. Like, you know, for I'd say 80% of the population, you can do it the easiest way through the guidelines. And for that 20%, then you have to figure out, okay, now what do? Well, we have to add in a little more friction. Okay, so that'll get us to the 90%. And then after that, what are we going to do? All right, we need to do a little more friction. Okay, now we've got like about 3% of the population that we still can't get through. What are we going to do there? And that's when we really have to start making those risk-based decisions and figuring out what our exceptions are going to be.
Yeah, and that becomes even more crucial when you're talking about public-facing applications, and in particular, protection of things like benefits programs, because these are oftentimes things people are, one, entitled to, but also, two, dependent upon for, you know, sometimes everyday capabilities, life, execution, getting through. And so it becomes very important to make sure you've got those processes built in to be able to help and handle people who really do have to get access to the things that they need to keep them themselves going on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other thing that I think is really interesting that I is the I was thinking about the evolution of 63 and how from 2 to 3 something big happened, and in at that point, like, there was a big breach, and at that point what was realized is that the standards were too pie in the sky and didn't meet the vendors. Like, vendor technology actually could not meet the standards even if they had tried. That's something that we learn in 2. So 3 went out and tried to, like, make it better and bring it down to the vendor level so that the vendors could actually meet it. And then that's why we took apart the LOAs, we added the XLs. And now what do you think was the big, not the impetus, but what was the big difference between 3 and 4?
Well, I think partially we learned a lot from 3, right? Like, I think 3 really, you know, I can't speak to all the motivations that went into the updates, and, you know, I was around, but not, like, directly engaged in everything that was happening. But what I can say is that it was a complete shift, right? Like, it was completely different than what was in revision 2. It was a substantive change into both, like, how the guidance was structured. We went from one big document to 4 other documents. And we changed the assurance level structure entirely. So, like, that's a total paradigm shift from what we were talking about in revision 2 to revision 3. And I think what happened was we essentially learned a lot over the past, essentially, I guess, 8 years since it was published, of what's working, what's not, what was clear and what was not. You know, very simple things like how vendors ultimately interpreted some of the guidance and how that impacted how we structured some of the requirements. You know, things like what kind of evidence, you know, we went from, you know, partially evidence-based process into a more or less entirely evidence-based process in revision 3. What kind of pieces of evidence were actually available? What was really fitting into the concept of evidence strength? What was available to users, what wasn't, but also looking at, like, what practically speaking was working from an implementation perspective as well too. So I think the big thing is we learned a lot from what was in 63.3 and several years of agencies and vendors and organizations looking to try and implement, right? So I think that is one of the big things that shifted, right? We now had a corpus of implementation information that we can turn to figure out how we can continue to refine 63 in revision 4. Obviously, the other thing was learning from identity systems getting attacked during the pandemic at a scale that we hadn't yet seen before. So, like, what were the successful attacks? What were the unsuccessful attacks? You know, what could we learn about what was done, what wasn't done in some of those protections that were being put in place at different organizations? And how did that feedback into things? So I think we had implementation experience. We had a complete shift in the world around identity, where identity kind of went from being a back burner thing to something that was very front and center in a lot of these applications, in a lot of these programs. And then we had a corpus of threat evidence and threat information to all kind of build in to understand what was happening and what wasn't happening. So I think those were, like, the 2 major things. And then obviously the 3rd thing that I kind of covered earlier is new technologies, right? Like, I think a huge thing that 63.3 attempted to do was lean forward on things like DocAuth and biometrics that were starting to scale at the time that it was being developed, but really weren't necessarily, you know, widely adopted just yet. We've attempted to keep some of that forward-leaning mentality when it comes to revision 4, particularly looking at, you know, things like wallet-based credentials or, pass keys and stuff like that. How do those fit into the bigger picture, and how can we potentially leverage some of those new technologies to both mitigate risk while also bringing in potentially some convenience and user control where it didn't previously exist?
Yeah, and I think the one thing that I actually liked the fact that I do think that the second revision of Dash 4 is even more forward leaning than the first. and kind of really dug into the technologies that we know at, like, back when it was written the first time, that we knew were going to start bubbling up and are now really bubbling up now, like mobile driver's licenses, digital identity wallets, et cetera. But the one thing that I think that practitioners or people who need to use the guidelines for whatever reason don't always understand is that in between three and the first revision, the first draft of four, there were actually, what do you guys call them, practice guides? What do you call them? There were supplemental documents.
Yeah. And we intend to continue to do that, right? Like, cause so are you talking about like the implementation resources, or are you talking about the supplement that we put? Yeah. So
I would think it's both, because part of that is that there were certain things in dash three. Like I think I'm too much of an insider of NIST. I think I need a shirt. This is obviously one of my shirts that is a Jeremy Grant-ism that you and I got to see on stage once. But there's in three, there were certain technologies that weren't advanced enough to really kind of put into the guidelines. And then there was, I think, a supplemental, or it was either that or called the implementation guideline. I don't remember which one you guys called it, but what it did essentially was say, okay, these technologies that were nascent when we published three are not in nascent anymore. So here's how you use them effectively to be able to do identity vetting.
Yeah, so what we try and do with like our implementation resources is take things to like ideally a next level of detail. So yeah, we put out implementation resources not long after 63.3 was published that included additional information on like, if you're doing inspection of documents, what are the kind of security features that you should be looking for? And if you're using, specific kinds of authenticators, here's like examples of what those look like. Because to be fair, a lot of times the guidance is not easy to digest if you're not familiar with some of the terminology. And a lot of times we have to use like generic forms of statements or more technically focused like descriptions of like authenticators or technology. And a lot of times, you know, practitioners are like, okay, I read, you know, multi-factor cryptographic authenticator. What is that? Like, give me an example of what that is, right? And so I think there's, what we try and do with the implementation resources is focus more on how do we make it practical and consumable. And then what we did with the supplement this past year was essentially 863.3 didn't really envision the paradigm of being able to potentially share things like authentication keys between different devices controlled by a user, which is how the kind of call it the passkey. And again, another example of us making generic terms, we call them syncable authenticators. They could be called passkeys, the FIDO2 web authent implementation of those things. But essentially,
so syncable authenticators are a subset of passkeys, but they are passkeys is the overarching.
Essentially, there's passkeys was a very loaded term, and there's a lot of very nuanced conversation that goes on around passkeys. And so what we wanted to do was very specifically focus on that syncable version, which was a new paradigm for kind of 63. And so we released our first ever supplement, and that essentially said, look, you can support these kinds of synced authenticators. And here's the requirements that you should be looking for when doing that. So we use supplements to do things like that. We use implementation resources to try and give people like a better understanding of what does this look like in the practical world. I would also say the one thing we're trying to do a lot more as well too is we have the National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, which for those who don't know about it, it's basically the place where we try and take the words that are in our guidance or in international standards and put them into like actual implementable code that can be used as reference architectures and demonstration implementations to help organizations understand what does this look like in the real world. So we're doing right now, one of the things we're doing there is how to use mobile driver's license and verifiable credentials in online workflows. And how can we kind of test out all the different standards that are starting to emerge there so that when we say, yeah, you can use digital evidence in 863. Okay, cool. What does that actually look like and how do I do it? Well, now we've got the NCCOE project that supports it. So you can actually see in practice, these are all the different things that need to be done and what it does from a risk mitigation perspective. So ideally, we'd have this world of the core guidance, which is where you've got kind of the requirements, but then you've got supporting implementation resources and NCCOE projects so that organizations that are out there going, how on earth do I do this? They've got a better blueprint and a better set of resources at their disposal to actually do the implementation side.
Yeah, but I also, this is my guess that I have. We haven't talked about this before, but my assumption is you also probably know who's doing what in the space because they come and tell you, right? So you might be able to connect. Like, I feel like I'm positive you've done this with agencies. You connect agencies up if they need help, right? So you can.
Yeah, being cognizant of all the different procurement requirements that exist in the world.
Exactly.
You know, what we try and do is when we do like work in the NCCOE, we've got an entire process with collaborative research and development agreements and like a very level set of field within the NCCOE. But when it comes to like more general conversations, a lot of times we'll take what we've learned from conversations with vendors and stuff like that and provide that as a, this is what we're seeing in the space more generically. This is what the vendors are kind of doing in the space. Here's some folks you may want to go talk to about some of the things that are happening. But I want to be clear, we don't like create matchmakers for like procurements and stuff like that.
No. I actually was trying to connect more as a small agency comes to you and asks questions. You probably know a big that has had that issue before, right? Yeah. I would never have you matchmake with vendors. That is not your job.
And yeah, I mean, like we talked to lots of agencies, we talked to lots of vendors, we talked to lots of members of academia, the research space. So like, you know, I'm not going to say we have the best view, but I think we have a really good view of a lot of things that are going on. And I think we try and be like a collection point for a lot of that stuff to be able to make sure it gets into the guidance where it makes sense, or create connections with our partners to make sure that they've got the ability to share information to the best of their capacity.
Yeah, and what's crazy is how many people actually work on these?
On the guidance documents?
Yeah.
I mean, David Temeshuk is the lead for 863 and has been for a while now. I'm a co-author, Connie LaSalle is a co-author, Andy Regenscheid. And then we have a really good team of contractors that support us. As well too, and really are kind of driving it, but it's really about 8 to 10 people at the end of the day.
Which is crazy. It's amazing how much you guys do with such a small team.
Thank you. I mean, I think there's a lot of folks in government across the board that have to do a lot of things with what's available from a resourcing perspective. So I don't know that we're unique in that particular.
I agree with you. I agree. But like your guidelines aren't just for, I mean, the effect is beyond federal, right? It's not just US federal. It's also commercial, really. You see it in state, local, academia, healthcare. You see requirements based on your guidelines in there all the time. And then on top of that, a lot of commercial companies are starting to go back to the guidelines to help figure out what the best way for them to do something is. And then you also have international standards that at least watch us. They used to follow us, but then we completely changed the guidelines. So now they watch us. But I mean, there's a lot, it's a pretty wide ranging, it like ripple effect of these guidelines. They're a lot bigger than just, federal agencies, they have to like deal with this again, which also sometimes vendors feels like that, but there's a lot of other people who also rely on these.
Yeah. And I think like, to be clear, we have 10 people that work on this, but we've got a huge accelerator in the community, right? Like, everything we do is through the public comment periods. And I think this speaks to why we do have the reach that we have with a lot of the work that comes out of NIST, is it's because it's a broader collaborative effort. And it's not just the 10 people that work here at NIST, kind of trying to come up with this stuff. It's taking the input, taking the feedback, taking the learnings from, the entire community in a way that actually promotes that kind of adoption and inclusion when it comes to participation. So Yeah, 8 to 10, 12 of us, generally speaking, working on a day-to-day basis, but we're taking the feedback and the best of what's coming out of an entire community of hundreds of thousands of practitioners. So it's not just us. And I think that hopefully speaks to like why a lot of people look to and view the work that we do as being as valuable and accessible as it is.
I wouldn't call it hundreds of thousands of practitioners, though. I
maybe,
feel like
maybe 20. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a pretty small community. So let's get into some of the things that changed, I would say, more significantly. And I don't want to go into like a lot of it, but I think one of the risk-based methodology changed significantly. Personally, I love it. Have you started getting feedback on that, or are you, what do you think is, how's that, do you think is going to be taken? Were you guys like a little scared when you pressed send on that one?
No, I wouldn't say scared. Cause I mean, this is why we do drafts, right? Like, there's going to be things in all of these documents that people really like, and there's going to be things that people really hate. And we need to be able to understand and balance those different things. Cause a lot of times, you know, there's two opposing, you're two different worldviews that might exist out there. People who are far more focused on the security side of the house. There are people who might be far more focused on the privacy side of the house. You know, people with a very focus on usability and accessibility. And we have to then take a lot of that feedback and balance it out. So there's going to be all kinds of different worldviews coming to this guidance. And as a result, no one's going to love everything that's in it. So that's part of the problem. And I think the risk management section is one of those places where there was, you know, we got a lot of very different feedback on it. So when we made the major change in December of 22, one of the things we got rid of were these kind of process step diagrams that basically said, if this, then that, then this, then your assurance level. And we got a lot of feedback from people during the comment period that like those were too confining and restricting, and agencies felt like they were, you know, they had to really focus on a compliance view of the world. And so we decided to go to something that was a bit more like RMF type oriented and aligned, that focuses more on the process while providing a bit more flexibility for agencies to really make decisions about the assurance levels based upon their context, their understanding, and less focused on, you know, following the lines down the chart. Some people loved the lines down the chart and were very angry that we took those out. And other people were like, this is exactly what we needed to be able to have a more risk-oriented posture when it comes to the guidance. And so we kind of continued to hew towards the risk-based approach and the risk-based concept within this most recent public draft. But there are two main changes that we made to that section. One, we added kind of like a step, it's step one, I think, but it like more of a step zero type concept of really understanding the online application that you're attempting to defend and protect, right? So we call it defining the online application or online service, but it's really like, who are the users? What are the data that's being used? What's the user population? What's the threat environment look like? Just collect all that information so you really understand like, this is the thing, you know? And that helps set all of the other conditions for all the other decisions that you're going to try and make throughout the process, as well as informing you to make sure you understand, like, these are all your different user types in particular. Because I think one of the things we had started to hear as we were having conversations was like, the application has the following assurance levels. And that isn't always the right paradigm, particularly if you've got different users that do different things. So if you've got a user that can do nothing more than go in and say like, hey, I'd like to request a copy of, you know, a super non-sensitive form, that's very different than like an administrative user that can potentially add and drop other people or change rights and stuff like that. They should be at a different assurance level. So we wanted to make sure that people were really thinking about all the different roles, all the different, you know, user types are going to be in an application, and also not just generally speaking what those are, but what can they actually do and with what data? And that would help inform all kind of the rest of the decision-making across the board. The other thing we did back in December that we've kind of doubled down on now is the idea of continuous improvement. And again, this is trying to push away from a focus on conformity and compliance and focus more on how well is what we're doing working. And so we said you have to have a continuous evaluation program in the draft that we put out in December of 22. this time we went through and we got a lot of feedback. Hey, you need to have metrics. You need to tell us what we need to be measuring here. So we put in a very large suite of recommended metrics. They're all recommended right now because it's probably going to take some time for organizations to develop the maturity and the data streams and the relationships within their organization that they need to have all that information. But looking at really practically speaking, how good are we doing? How well are we defending against fraud? What's our pass and fail rates? What kind of evidence are people actually using, and what's being successful in the process and what's not being successful in the process? Where are we getting complaints? Like, that's a huge thing. Like, a lot of times you can understand where your process is not doing the right thing by users calling in and complaining about, hey, I constantly have to do password reset. Hey, I get stuck trying to use your biometric match every single time I come through. And you can start to collect that information. That's not always in the identity program. That might be with like a customer service rep or customer engagement rep. You need to be pulling that in to be able to understand how well you're doing as a program and be able to look at your identity solution as something that is supporting an overall application and really create that picture of how well we're doing. And that allows you to adjust your controls over time to be able to say, we have an informed, perspective on how to apply certain aspects of our process and our controls.
Yeah, no, I think I really like the concept of pulling apart the users as well and not just saying the application, because when you do that for pretty much any government application, you're going to find that there's some highly sensitive information in there. And so you're just going to say it's IL3, AL3, FAL3 across the board. But that's not really true because, of course that's true for the administrators, but then if it comes down to all a user is doing is submitting a form through an end user that's external is submitting a form, then that's it, right? So that's not as big of a deal, especially like if it's something, for example, a FOIA system that can be near anonymous. So
another great example is like applications that support guest payments, right? Like those might come out as like a moderate or high level overall application because they're processing financial information, but users that are only doing this specific action might be much lower risk. It might not require proofing at all in certain instances. So really being able to understand in a nuanced way all the different things that are happening in the application and that users can and can't do, I think is really important in what we're trying to set up with that that initial step in the risk management process.
Yeah, and I think it's great. Now that I'm on the vendor side and not a practitioner, I think it's even better. I really do think that this is something that has, I think a lot of practitioners did a subset of this for a long time anyway. So kind of codifying it is really important. But of course, I'm not upset that I'm sure that's going to get filtered into FSMA somehow and it's going to get become something else. But I don't have to deal with it. I'm not sad. the other thing that I think was pretty big is, and I'm very happy that there's a lot of discussion on this in the current draft, is wallets and MDLs. And I think I know that was one of my big comments that, just doing a line really wasn't going to cut it for practitioners. So you guys really did a deep dive into that. How did you gather the information to be able to get that deep dive? Like what are the outside sources that you use to be able to work on that?
I mean, so there is so much going on right now when it comes to things like wallets and the credentials they contain, whether it's mobile driver's license or verifiable credentials. We really tried over the past year to like embed ourselves in the conversations that were going on at organizations like W3C, the OpenID Foundation. We've had folks like Ketan Mehta who've been working in ISO on the ISO standards around mobile driver's license for years now. So really just kind of trying to the best of our ability, wrap our arms around where those things were going. But also like the important thing to remember with a lot of the stuff is like a lot of the standards that are going into using those things online still aren't done, right? And so when we put out the initial draft in 22, we wanted to, again, crack the door there, but there wasn't a lot for us to go off of yet because things like 18013-7 were still being like very, you know, being developed in their early stages. A lot of the work being done at the OpenID Foundation around things like OpenID for verifiable presentations was still very early days. And now 2 years on, things have matured a lot more. So we've been able to see where the, you know, like overall where the direction was going and how can we learn from what they were doing there and how the protocols were evolving to be able to start put together requirements. And again, we try and stay to the greatest degree possible in the guidance itself, in the requirements development. So protocol agnostic, because, you know, there might be protocols developed in 2 or 3 years that we weren't envisioning now that we want to be able to meet the requirements, but we don't want to have to say you have to use a specific protocol to be compliant or to meet our requirements. So, you know, we've been watching those things, watching as they evolve. And I mean, even today, you know, 18013-7 is not yet published. It hopefully will be published pretty soon, which is, for those who don't know, it's the, you know, it's got the requirements for the mobile driver's license for online usage. We've also been engaging very heavily with our colleagues across the pond in Europe who are working on EIDAS 2.0, which mandates the development of a European digital identity wallet. So being able to observe and get feedback from them on what they're doing with their, or get inputs rather from them on what they're doing with their digital wallets and what they're doing with their architectural reference framework. A lot of things we're learning from the work that they're doing as well too. So we're just kind of doing our best to wrap our arms around where the overall space is going with respect to these kinds of implementations. And ideally, you know, hopefully we did a good job on it. I mean, it's probably not going to be perfect yet, but we're hoping to get there to have those kind of core requirements in 63C in particular for how do you actually present something out of these wallets in a way that can be consumed in a, with confidence and with a degree of protection that we're looking for from an assertion perspective. So just a lot of work going on and really wrapping our arms around a lot of the good work that the larger community is doing in this space already.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to think about when some of us are crafting those comments. In fact, because we're all thinking about it, I think in a very similar way, how wallets are gonna end up kind of blowing up and changing the way that we interact. I actually thought about it the other day, and I can leave the house with just my mobile device and I would be fine. I can, and a key. I do need a key to drive my car, but I don't need anything else. I don't need a driver's license anymore because Virginia has a mobile driver's license. I have the ability to put payments on my phone and to pay through NFC. So I don't really need much anymore. And when we get to a place where we really double down on verifiable credentials and digital identity wallets, it's going to be amazing. I'm like very excited about that. Five years from now.
I think there's a ton of potential. There's a lot of challenges that still need to be worked out as well too. And you know, kind of understanding how this is all going to work at like a national level. I think there's still some work to be done there, but tons of potential. And what we like to what I was trying to say earlier, we really wanted to make sure that we got as much right now as we can to make sure that we can open the door to having that kind of future capability within the guidance, particularly as those technologies begin to scale more and hopefully not get stale, but scale more across, you know, across the US and become more available. Because again, it's one of the first times that we're starting to see really a form of authoritative identity that is made to be used in a digital manner, right? Like a lot of what we do right now is doing our best to gain confidence through physical means of identification, like driver's licenses and passports. And it doesn't always convey as well as we'd like into the digital space. And so this is one of the first opportunities we've got to really leverage this emerging technology within the context of how we've done identity proofing and authentication.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I tried to use my MDL at a airport lounge recently, and they got very angry at me. They told me that they do KYC and it's not allowed in KYC. And I said it will be one day. Mark my words. I was very tired. I had to go searching for my driver's license.
One of the things we're really doing with the mobile driver's license project as well too in the NCCOE is trying to get that voice of the relying party understood and help relying parties like that lounge or like people doing KYC understand how that fits into their overall context, their regulatory environment, to be able to say, because again, you can have this great technology, but if the relying parties aren't aware of how it functions, aren't aware of how it aligns to regulation, they're not going to adopt it, which means you just have a driver's license or a digital technology that's not as valuable as it could be. So we really want to make sure that we start to understand how it fits into like actual process at the relying party side, how it fits into risk, you know, risk scenarios at the relying party side. And that's why within the mobile driver's license project, we're focused on essentially three core sectors, like looking at what's being done from a KYC customer identification program perspective and financial institutions and how MDL can fit there or verifiable credential can fit there. Looking at the government sector. So how does it actually fit in practice into our own guidance and guidelines? And then third, looking at the healthcare perspective and how it can support certain use cases there as well too. And we're not confining ourselves to strictly mobile driver's license there. So, you know, if you're out there and you're thinking about, you know, not just driver's license, but other forms of digital credentials you'd be interested in, that's something we're exploring as well too.
Yeah, I think that's really important because that's essentially what FIDO had to deal with, right, with passkeys. So they, what was it, like 2.5 years ago, they did a big splash at RSA and said, passkeys! And then came the real work was getting reliant parties to actually use passkeys. Since then, they've had a massive adoption rate, not only of end users actually signing up and obtaining passkeys, but also of very large US and actually there's a large APEC, lots of people in APEC are doing this too, where those relying parties are using them for generally for consumers, but also for internal workforce. Because again, passkeys is a big umbrella of, it essentially means FIDO. So I think that piece is the devil in the details of getting that adoption. And that's definitely, I think you're right. I think we have, the technology is getting better and better, and it's definitely getting there. And so then now we have to have, like, for example, IDPs be able to consume verifiable credentials or MDLs. And currently in the marketplace, there are a couple IDPs, but not all of them can. So getting IDPs either to move to that or, you know, creating a federation to be able to push it over. So there's just a lot to definitely continue to do for the wallet space, but I think it's going to be really cool when we get there. And I think we're going to get there pretty soon.
There's certainly no lack of work in this space.
There's never a lack of work in this space. So I have to end with my favorite question to you, and you know exactly what this question is because it's the hill I will die on. And I tell you this all the time, which is why won't you pull apart? So why won't you pull apart AAL2?
We've had a lot of conversations about this and, you know, back and forths. And I think the challenge with assurance levels, no matter how you structure them, is that you can always shift the lines left and right a little bit. And with authentication, it becomes in particularly really challenging because of the diversity of authenticators that I think we have today, including things like passkeys and, you know, what becomes AAL2 versus what's not AAL2 and how do you represent that? You know, we could draw the line on one side of SMS OTP, or we can draw the line on OTPs in general, or just phishing resistant. And then we've got, what about phishing resistant plus, you know, device bound? Is that like we could end up with 7 assurance levels, who knows? I think what we're hoping to see happen with a lot of this and what we're working on is how can you represent a more rich set of authentication content and context in assertions that can allow for agencies to, one, say, this is what I want, so that an IDP can respond to it appropriately, but also make sure the IDP can tell you, hey, look, this is a phishing resistant authentication event. So ideally, we would like for some of that granularity to not necessarily be handled in the assurance levels, but potentially as, you know, authentication context within assertions and within technical protocol exchanges to allow those kinds of risk-based decisions. And also they can be handled in policy as well too. So when you're setting up your federation and say, look, I am happy to accept the following kinds of authenticators, I am not happy to accept these other ones. So that's where we kind of stand on it. Because again, like drawing lines within the assurance levels is really hard. Particularly when you've got that large diversity of authenticators. And in practice, I'm not sure how much it would change the actual implementation of most public-facing applications. So that's where we currently stand on it. I know you don't necessarily agree, but
I don't. It's okay. I'm gonna keep
this is
writing
why we
my
have public
comments.
Comment periods.
They're my favorite comments to write. I actually need to go dig up one of my comments so I can like double down on it. But yeah, no, I hear you. I understand it, but I think that too many IDPs are not having the level of veracity that they need, especially when it comes to a federated environment. This is something that I also, that's another hill I will die on, and something I talked about a lot when I was a practitioner. And so I think that that's a really important piece. So, but I understand also the amount of ripple effect that would occur within the federal space. And that's the other issue, right? So it's been fun, as always, talking with you. I do want to highlight for one of my friends out there, Timmy, who better watch this show, that you have a very cute mini me and you in a Bruins outfit right behind you. And I love it. It's so cute. But thank you so much for joining. I love it. I love it. I can't wait to see you probably next week, because there's so much going on in DC next week on identity.
You got Identity Week next week.
I know. It's crazy. Which probably will not be next week by the time this comes out, but I feel like Identity Week has blown up this year. I didn't think it was going to be as big, but it seems like it's going to be pretty big. So
it's always a good opportunity to have people in town. Like, it's not often that we get to stay put and have everyone come to us. So it's a good chance to get in touch with people.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. All right. Well, thanks so much, and have a wonderful day, everybody.